Please open your Bible to Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Hopefully you've got some markers that you can use to readily flip back and forth between those three passages. This is the Olivet Discourse of Jesus, a prophetic discourse, a discourse in which he talks about his second coming, but as we should be able to learn, he definitely talks about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. This was all precipitated when Jesus, on Wednesday, just a couple of days before his crucifixion, is leaving the temple complex, and his apostles are doing the whole sightseeing routine and talking about how grand this temple complex is, how amazing all the building construction is, and how tremendously large and ornate all of the stones are. And I shared with you the size we know of these stones in the temple complex being many hundreds of tons, very long, very broad, and high. I've actually stood at the southwest corner of the Temple Mount on several occasions now, and I'm always just shocked at how amazing these Herodian ashlar stones are. One in particular, I always like to put my hand up against it, is almost 40 feet long, and it's almost 8 feet tall, and then it's about a couple of cubits wide, that is 43 inches or so wide. Just an amazing thing to see. And see the Western Stone down at the base of the Western Wall, down in the rabbinical tunnels, which is even bigger. That one is probably close to 330 tons, and it's 44 and a half feet long. Just shocking how big it is. And you have to just be amazed at the mechanical engineering that allowed Herod's engineers to quarry and move and place all of these stones. So all of that stuff up on the Temple Mount, those sort of size of stones were put in place for all of the temple complex buildings, the shrine building, all of the court buildings around. Lots and lots of pillars, lots and lots of gold decoration. Many of the people in the last several decades since Herod had refurbished the temple, had donated things to the glory of God to be displayed in this temple. And so that's what the apostles were pointing out. Let's read again from Mark chapter 13. As he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones, what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Now that's exactly what you find in Matthew 24 and Luke chapter 21 as well. Same sort of wording. Not one stone here on the Temple Mount, up on ground level of Temple Mount, is going to be left upon another. They're all going to be gone, all taken down. Now, Jesus had actually said those same words a few days earlier. We're currently on the 12th day of the first month in the Olivet Discourse, but Jesus, on the 10th day of the first Jewish month, during his triumphal entry, had wept over the city. This is in Luke 19:42, saying, "Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you, surround you, and hem you in on every side." That's clearly a reference to military action against Jerusalem, siege ramps and such. Verse 44, "They will tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation. So the temple specifically, the temple complex, not one stone was going to be left upon another in it, because they had not properly responded to the visitation of God Himself in the form of Yehoshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. They had instead killed Him. And so the judgment of God was about to come. And so Jesus has mentioned this not one stone left upon another thing twice in about 3 days' time. And so in Mark chapter 13, it says, as he sat, this is verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Now, this is what I emphasized at the close yesterday when I was introducing all of this. Jesus was in the habit of leaving the temple complex every day of Passover and heading back to Bethany. That road takes him up over the Mount of Olives. And along the way, he seems to have been in the habit of stopping at the Garden of Gethsemane. How do we know that? Because that's where Judas caught up with him, and we're told specifically he knew that Jesus would be there because he customarily stopped there. So the Garden of Gethsemane, a working olive press garden, the Garden of Gethsemane seems to be high enough on the slope of the Mount of Olives that Jesus could stop there and be able to look across the Kidron Valley into the Temple Mount and see what's going on there. And so that's where I want you to picture it. When you go to Israel, the touristy places that they show you for the Garden of Gethsemane are down in the Valley of the Kidron. And immediately after I saw that, I went, well, this is not authentic. This is not even possible because it has to be higher up on the slope. So Mark chapter 13 tells us that once he sat down in the Garden of Gethsemane, looking across toward the Temple Mount, that Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately. So this is the inner circle of Jesus plus one. So Peter, Andrew, Peter, James, John, that's the inner circle. Andrew is just on the fringe of that inner circle because these are the two sets of brothers that were the first disciples of Jesus. Two of them are Jesus' cousins. So they come to him privately and they say to him this. And this is where we're going to have to bounce back and forth between the three accounts because I want you to hear that while they think they're asking one question, just an expanded form of it, they end up asking two separate questions. And so in Jesus' Olivet Discourse, he answers the two separate questions. And we must learn to discern between those two answers because it's important to understanding prophecy. All right, so here we go. Mark 13:4. Tell us, when will these things be? Now, what things are they talking about? When not one stone will be left upon another on the Temple Mount. That's what Jesus had just told them about. That's what they want to know about. So tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Now, that's the question that basically we can say it this way. When will the temple be destroyed? When will there not be one stone left upon another? Matthew makes it plain that that's what, Luke makes it plain that that's what they're asking as well. Here's Luke 21, verse number 6. Verse number 7. They asked him, "Teacher, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place?" So what are they asking? They want to know, when's the temple going to be destroyed, and will we see any signs that that's about to happen? Because that's a big deal. And you want to be prepared for that sort of thing as a Jewish person. So that's the main question. When will the temple be destroyed? Now, we, living historically past all these events, we know that the temple was destroyed in AD 70. We further know that, exactly as Jesus said, not one stone was left upon another on the Temple Mount. Now, I've been there, and I hope that some of you listening might even join the next time we go there in October of this year. When we stand at the temple, actually, we never go up on the Temple Mount itself. That's a kind of religious area for Muslims, and you have to make special arrangements to go up there. And I don't want to mess with the hassle. When you stand down below the Temple Mount, such as at the southwest corner, you can see the Herodian stones up to the level of the Temple Mount, and then they end. They're not above that line because when the Romans dismantled the Temple Mount, they dismantled it completely, shoved everything over the edge, or had it removed, or broke it up and had it removed. In the southwest corner, there along the western side of the Temple Mount retaining wall, you can see some of the stones that were pushed off and crashed down below into the paving stones, crashed and broke the paving stones. One of the stones on that southwest corner happens to be the top stone of the tower of the southwest. And it's called the Trumpeting Stone because it had an inscription on it, "To the place of trumpeting." Josephus actually mentions that there was a place where the trumpeters went on a tower at the Temple Mount to announce the coming of the Sabbath. And more than likely, they also went there to announce the coming of the new month, as well as the holy days. And so that capstone, the very top stone of the southwest corner, is laying in the valley just below where it crashed. And it's further evidence not one stone was left upon another on the Temple Mount. None. The walls that you see when you see the Temple Mount today, all the buildings that you see there, including the big golden dome structure of the rock mosque, all of that has been built since AD 70 and is not part of this story. And the Dome of the Rock actually sits where the Jewish temple used to sit. It's about half the height of what the temple would have been. But it's all gone. So the apostles' primary question is, when will the temple be destroyed? But let's go to Matthew 24 now and see that they asked a secondary question, because they misunderstood chronology. This is Matthew 24, verse number 3. "Tell us, when will these things be?" So when will the temple be destroyed? "And what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" Now that's a totally different topic, isn't it? We know that because we're living past the destruction of the temple that happened in AD 70, and Jesus has not yet made his second coming appearance, and the end of the age has not yet occurred. So we see here in Matthew's account two separate questions. Jesus also would have known that there were two separate questions there, and he will answer both questions. But the primary question, the one that he starts with, is the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Now, I want to encourage you at this point to just go with the flow of the passage as we study through it. And don't allow yourself to be totally confused by teachings that have already been done, as if Matthew 24 is all about the second coming of Jesus. Because I've heard sermons like that myself, and I've read commentaries that are very much like that. Because Matthew 24 is not just simply about the second coming of Jesus. On the other side of the coin, there are some commentators, some preachers out there that will tell you that everything in Matthew 24 and the parallels from Mark and Luke are about the destruction of Jerusalem, and that there's nothing here about the second coming of Jesus. And I'm going to tell you that's wrong as well, because there are clearly things here about the second coming of Jesus. And so let's not allow ourselves to be distracted by eschatological misadventure. Eschatology is the study of last things. There are plenty of people that have given bad information about this Olivet Discourse. Let's do the Bible thing. Let the Bible be its best own interpreter. And let's let the wording flow for itself. I want you to keep your eyes open for this. Grammatically, when we talk about something that is near to us in time or space, we say this and these. When we're talking about things that are farther away in time and space, we say that and those. Well, that's not just English. Many languages have those sort of relative pronouns. And so does Greek. And so Jesus is going to refer to the destruction of Jerusalem's Temple Mount as these things, as in they're coming near. They're coming near in time and space. He will refer to the day of his coming and the close of the age as that day, referring to it being farther out on the chronological scale. And so just keep your eyes open for that as we go through these passages. So let's see how Jesus answers. Since we're in Matthew 24, let's start there at verse number 4. Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray." So right off the bat, he says, don't let yourself get duped. All right? "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ, I'm the Christos, I'm the Messiah, I'm the Messiah.' And they will lead many astray." So Jesus warns them that before the temple gets destroyed, there will be these false messiahs. And folks, the history book of Acts makes note of that, and so does Josephus's history books, the books of the Antiquities and the books of the Wars of the Jews. There was a plethora of these false messiahs. And the Jewish people were prone to give them a hearing because of this reality. In the book of Daniel, chapter number 9, there is a countdown prophecy that tells us that there's going to be a 490-year period from the command to rebuild Jerusalem, including its walls, until the Messiah shows up. And so the people of the Jews that believed the scripture, they had watched the time tick off, and they knew when they were living in this time period that we're in right now with Jesus, they knew they had to be living in the time of the Messiah. And so in Jesus' day, the religious Jews were wound up tight. You remember when John the Immerser came along, they were wondering whether or not he might be the Messiah. And he had to tell them no. And then they were excited when Jesus comes along. Well, in later years following this, other false messiahs will come forward, and they'll get a whole bunch of people killed, even themselves killed, and cause lots of trouble. One of them will actually get tens of thousands of their followers together on the Mount of Olives and claim that he was going to make the walls of Jerusalem fall down so that he and his followers could go in and take the place over. Didn't happen because he was a fake. But here's Jesus saying, look, don't get tricked. Don't get duped. There will be many coming claiming that they are the Messiah. It's not true. Verse number 6, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you're not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. So Jesus tells his followers, in answer to the question, when will these things be? When will the temple be destroyed? He says, look, you're going to hear of all sorts of turmoil, lots of fighting going on, wars, rumors of wars. I want you to understand now that you shouldn't panic, because that doesn't mean the end of the temple is coming just that moment. We need to apply the contextual meaning of words here, don't we? When we see the word the end, and we've been told that this is a passage about the second coming of Jesus, then we have a tendency to go along with that. And that's what I'm afraid a lot of people have done. But when we actually read the context, we see here that the end Jesus is referring to is the end of the temple, when not one stone's going to be left upon another. And so he's told his apostles, don't panic when turmoil happens, because it's not time yet. Verse 7, still in the same context. For nation, and it's basically the word for ethnic group here, ethnic group will rise against ethnic group, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. So Jesus warns them, yes, it's going to get bad. You're going to have ethnic groups fighting against ethnic groups. You're going to have kingdoms fighting against kingdoms. You're going to have famines, earthquakes, all those scary things. But that's just the beginning of the process that will eventually end in the temple being destroyed and not one stone being left upon another. And guess what? Book of Acts, the Antiquities of the Jews, Wars of the Jews, record all of this happening in the years between Jesus' Olivet Discourse, that'd be AD 33, and the beginning of the Jewish war with Rome, and that's AD 66, with the temple being destroyed in AD 70. So everything that we've looked at so far, and the parallels in Mark and Luke are similar, is that we're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem still, not the second coming of Jesus. Now, verse number 9 of Matthew 24. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations, all ethnic groups, for my name's sake. So Jesus also warns them, not only are you going to have all of these scary things happening around you, you're also going to see persecution against the faith. As my disciples, you're going to be persecuted. You will be hated. And Jesus warns them about this reality in other places. They hated me, they're going to hate you. They treated me harsh, they're going to treat you harsh. Verse 10, then many will fall away, that is, they will abandon the faith, and betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. All of that happened in early church history, didn't it? Between the death of Jesus and the destruction of Jerusalem. It's in the book of Acts. And because of lawlessness, because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. That is, they won't care about people they should have naturally cared about. One of the things that we actually see is in the church, especially in the Jewish church early on, people would betray relatives because they said that they believed in Jesus as Messiah. And that immediately prompted those on the side of Jewish leadership to abandon those family members. When the persecutions of Paul was going on, family members were betraying family members in all of that. All of this is the warning of Jesus that in this intervening four decades, it's going to get rough on you, the believers. But he tells them this in verse 13, "But the one who endures to the end will be saved." Now, the tendency of most people, again, because of the teaching here, is this is about the second coming of Jesus only, is that you just have to hold on until the second coming of Jesus. Instead, I want you to hear this in the context of you need to hold on to the faith until you die. In the book of Revelation, in one of the books about the overcomers, there at the very beginning, one of the letters in the beginning of the book of Revelation, Jesus says, "Be faithful even unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." That's what's being emphasized here in Matthew 24, verse 13. The one who endures to the end is going to be saved. In the Luke account, the way this is described is that not a hair on your head will perish. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. But right before that, he'd said, some of you are going to be put to death. So it is clear contextually that the life Jesus is referencing here and the salvation he is referencing here is spiritual salvation and spiritual life. And that no matter what the crowd does to you, no matter what the kingdoms do to you, you need to stick with the faith and be saved. We're out of time for the day, so mark your place right there, and we'll get back into the Word tomorrow.